Okay, now it gives me great pleasure to introduce Bill Evans, who is the Chief Economist at Westpac, and he's the bank's economic spokesman, responsible for all of the bank's economic research. He has a very busy schedule, so we're very lucky that he's taken time out of that to join us today. And he's going to give us a roundup of what's happening globally and how it will affect the Australian economy. Please join me in welcoming Bill Evans.
Thanks for that introduction, Melinda. And Andrew, while I was watching that presentation, I was trying to work out whether you'd be able to find out that I drink red wine every night. I suspect that if you found that out, I wouldn't be too great a candidate for your policies. Look, what I'll talk about today is mainly around the Australian economy, but certainly some implications that the global economy has for the Australian economy and a couple of particular issues. Let me start Let me start by just giving you a what? Is that the one? We'll use that one. That one works? That one doesn't work? I need to point up there? It's all right now? Okay. All right, so I'll say a few words about the budget, about the housing market, our economy and the markets and the impact the global economy has on our markets. So let me start just by refreshing your attention to the budget. The budget was a pretty spectacular improvement in the fiscal position of Australia. Back in December, the expectation was that we wouldn't be getting a surplus until 2021. And they were able to bring that forward a year to 1920. Main reason why they were able to do that was that the fiscal position this year was extraordinarily better than they expected. And that was mainly driven by stronger employment growth, higher commodity prices, and some companies that ran out of tax losses earlier than they were expecting. So the position was improved by $7 billion, and they were able to pass that all the way through each of the future years. My view is that the forecasts are probably a little optimistic. If you particularly look at 1920, they're expecting nominal GDP growth of 4.75%. I think it'll only be 3.2%. I think they're too optimistic about the achievement of higher inflation and also the critical challenge for the Australian economy, which is very weak wages growth. The assumption is that within a couple of years, wages growth will be back to around 3.75%. As you know, it's stuck at around 1.9% for the private sector at the moment. Politically, the government has some real challenges because the Labor Party has a number of different policies to the governments in terms of not allowing all the tax cuts to go through. The government wants tax cuts for all companies. At this stage, the only legislated tax cuts are those with turnover of $50 million or less. If those extra tax cuts don't go through, then Labor will have about $35 billion extra relative to the government. The franking credits that you've read a lot about is worth $56 billion over 10 years, $10 billion in the next 4 or 5 years. The negative gearing and capital gains, that was a policy in 2016 where negative gearing is denied for new properties. It will be grandfathered. And capital gains discount will be cut from 50% to 25%. That's worth $49 billion. Eliminating a lot of the tax benefits of family trusts will be worth another $17 billion, and restoring the budget deficit levy, so increasing the top tax rate for higher income earners from 45% to 47%. That will give them about $180 billion over the course of the next 10 years that the government doesn't have. And so it puts them in a very strong position. And as you know, they offered bigger tax cuts over the next 4 years that will cost about $10 billion. So the franking credits were enough over the next 4 years to allow them to offer that bigger tax cut, not $550, but $900. That will mean that it's going to be quite a tight election. If at the moment we're looking at the government has gained a little bit of ground recently, particularly on the restatement of One Nation preferences. And so it looks like it might be close, but as you can see, there's only a one-seat majority that the government has, and even with a 49-51, that's a pretty comfortable victory for the ALP. So businesses will have to, over the course of the next 12 months, will have to be very much thinking about the risks of political change. And we know that when that happens, when businesses are nervous about change, political uncertainty, they tend to be less aggressive on their investment and less aggressive on their employment decisions. The marginal seats across the country dominated by Queensland. So Queensland will, the numbers I have up there is the amount of money that was given in the budget for infrastructure spending. And the 7.4 for Victoria, 5 of that is the train, the Tullamarine train, which I suspect won't go ahead. So really, Queensland has got the most money, and Queensland will be the real battle, the battle state. And you'll find that the politicians will be spending more and more time up in Queensland, given how they swing. You can recall the Rudd slide in 2007, where 10 seats swung towards Labor in Queensland. Then, of course, they all swung back again in 2010 with Tony Abbott. So that will be the area of most uncertainty. Let me now make a comment about the housing market. It's been a pretty dramatic change in the housing market in the last 6 months. The six-month annualised pace of house price inflation is now down to about minus 8% in Sydney. Melbourne prices are about to fall, Brisbane prices are about to fall, and Perth prices have been falling for about the last 4 years. This is quite a substantial change in the environment that we haven't. We saw it in 2016, but then, of course, the Reserve Bank cut interest rates. And in cutting interest rates, they rebooted the housing market. This time, that's not going to happen. In fact, they've indicated that in their expectation, the next move on interest rates will be up rather than down. If interest rates go up in the way many people are expecting, it will be very damaging for the housing market. Why have house prices fallen this time? It is curious, because if we look at this red line, which is the debt servicing ratio, so that's the proportion of your income allocated to servicing your debt. And the grey areas show when house prices have fallen in the past. Now, what you notice is that every previous cycle apart from this one, house prices have fallen in response to a rise in those debt servicing ratios. And, of course, the key driver of debt servicing ratios are interest rates. This time, however, it's been more to do with regulation and the fact that the banks have been under a lot of pressure to cut back on their lending to investors and now, of course, to make it much more difficult to lend money. Banks are now asked to categorise people's incomes and expenditure much more in much more detail, and so you are much more measured in terms of your ability to service a loan rather than previous cycles. It was all about the loan to valuation ratio. And that means that people are getting less money, and it's really starting to have an impact on investors. Investors are the ones that may have bought three or four properties, now very hard to be able to do that. And what you'll find is that we saw the fall in investor lending back in 15-16, which reversed itself. You'll find that this one will just keep falling. Why would you be an investor in the Sydney market at the moment? After land tax, a lot of net yields are around 1%. You're potentially looking at a change of government next year, which will eliminate the benefits of negative gearing. And the general psychology at the moment is for prices to be falling. So the investors leaving the market is going to have quite an impact upon this market over the next 12 months. If we look across the states, New South Wales is a key investor market. New lending's down about 17% there, but it's down 23% in Brisbane. You've had a very sharp fall recently in Victoria. and a 20% fall in Western Australia. So as this investor story evolves, so we'll find that it's going to be very hard to maintain these current levels of house prices. Another major development has been in the global markets, and that is short-term funding rates. So when Mr. Trump decided to increase the tax cuts and the spending in the US, Treasury had to borrow a lot more money. That put upward pressure on short-term interest rates in the US. The tax rules also meant that foreign companies could no longer get tax deductions from intercompany loans. They had to borrow in the domestic market as well. That put further upward pressure on rates. And on the supply side, the Fed is no longer buying, and the tech companies that were massive buyers of paper are now wanting to maintain their liquidity, just in case the boss rings up and says, excuse me, we now want to buy back shares, because they've been able to move the money back to the US. So the combination of all those factors has led to a sharp rise in what we call LIBOR, which is the short-term borrowing rate in the US. And Australian banks rely a lot on LIBOR for their funding, and so it's directly led to a big rise in the BBSW, bank bill swap rate, which affects the borrowing of our corporates. So there's been, as a result of these developments in the US, there's been a substantial tightening in interest rates for corporates. It hasn't affected the mortgage rates yet, because banks are very uncomfortable about their mortgage policies at the moment, for reasons that you read in the paper every day. Let me now make some comments about the economy. There's two major themes about the Australian economy at the moment. The most important theme is around consumption and income growth. The black line there is household income growth, and the red line is consumption. So as you can see, for about the last 3 or 4 years, Australians have been spending at a faster pace than their incomes have been growing at. And the question about what happens in the future is, will we see a sharp an increase in income growth? Will wages start to come back? Will hours worked continue to grow as rapidly as they did last year? And will we stop seeing this movement from high-income jobs to low-income jobs? I suspect none of those factors are going to happen. And as a result, I think we're going to be stuck with this low-income story for some time to come. Now, the problem is people have been subsidising their spending with cutting into their savings rates. We're not going back to the level of savings rate that we had pre-GFC, where people were basically spending on the basis of the increase in the equity in their houses. So we're going to reach a point where people will have to reassess their spending if we don't see that boost in incomes. And I'm not that confident that we'll actually see that. In terms of our own measurement, the red line there is our expectation for income growth. The orange is what we think about wages, so I don't really see that wages will be picking up in the way the government is expecting. And the combination of that means that we have to go into an extended period where income growth remains soft, which will eventually take its toll on consumption. Consumption's obviously 60% of the economy, and it's also the key signal for business investment in equipment. The other dominant development in the economy is around the construction cycle, which is very much being driven by population growth. So when we look at business confidence, there's been a lot of coverage on business confidence. We notice that the red line, which is the construction, manufacturing, mining sector, confidence is on fire. Mining mainly because it hasn't got any worse and they're starting to gradually improve, but construction because non-residential construction is booming, and of course infrastructure spending by state governments is also boosting construction. If we look at where the jobs have been added in Australia over the last couple of years, education and health, the dominant source of jobs, foreign students, the ageing of the population that Andrew talked to us about before, has been the dominant way in which jobs have been added in Australia. The second one has been construction. But when we look a bit further down, we notice that white-collar jobs have contracted. So bankers in particular are worried about artificial intelligence. They're worried about services being offered now in China and India. Productivity growth is low. When I talk to a businessman and say, why aren't you raising wages? And he'll say, well, if I can increase my prices, I will, but I can't. So all of these factors have meant that the confidence around the white-collar sector is quite worrying. The other spectacular story, of course, is around infrastructure spending by state governments. So as you can see, New South Wales is absolutely on fire. Western Sydney benefiting dramatically. Victoria continues to boom. And the growth in the southeast of Australia, driven by population growth and government spending, has very, very important. What's not coming through is the consumer sector and the retail sector that is important to get a balanced improvement in the economy. As I said, another key driver for Australia has been population growth. So if we look at our population growth is stronger than pretty much all developed economies, and even than the average of developing economies. And it's population growth that's holding us in good stead. Unfortunately, the population story is very much focused on the southeast. So if you look at the spectacular story in Victoria, where they've been the only state that's growing above the national average, New South Wales is back at the national average, having never been there for a long time. But the mining states and South Australia continue to struggle. And as the population story starts to focus more on the southeast, so you'll start to see a bigger widening in the relative performance of the states. And Victoria in particular, if we look at the five-year moving average growth for Victoria, you can see that it's just outperforming dramatically. So whilst a lot of businesses are focused on New South Wales and say New South Wales is the centre of everything, it's not. New South Wales has hit that population ceiling about 1.5, 1.6% a number of times, whereas Victoria has sailed through it and continues to do extraordinarily well. And you can see one of the main factors behind that is that the unambiguously strong part of the economy, apart from the construction cycle, has been services exports. That's education and tourism. And that's dominated by Victoria and New South Wales. Services exports, that's foreign students and tourism, is now about 80% of what we spend on building new houses. And it's 130% of our agricultural exports. And it's growing at around 10% a year. Over the last 3 years, foreign students have grown by 50% in terms of school student fees and what they spend when they're here. And that, for Australia, is the way in which we can benefit from the growth in the prosperity of the Asian region without taking on all those risks that you take on by trying to compete over there. I believe this will be something that will be a sustained support for growth in Australia for a long while to come. But as you can see, if we look at the international students, you can see where Victoria and New South Wales dominate. And the mining states that are focusing on the benefit of mining have lost their way. And this is one of the other reasons why the southeast is going to be that sector that will do the best going forward. Let me make a comment now on the markets. Our forecast for the central bank, the Reserve Bank, is that they will remain on hold for this year and next year. So last year, when the other banks were saying that the RBA was going to start raising rates in 17 and 18, they interviewed me and I said, no movement in 17, no movement in 18, no movement in 19. And a lot of the thinking behind that was, one, the political uncertainty issue, and two, this challenge that we have with incomes and the weakness in consumption. We stick with that view, and most banks have now pushed back their timing for rate hikes, although you'll find that you'll still get most of them saying they're going to raise rates in 19. Why on earth would you raise interest rates in an economy that's going to be dealing with a very weak housing market and is not able to generate that income growth that's necessary to create sustained prosperity? As a result, the Federal Reserve, of course, will keep raising rates. Their unemployment rate is 3.9%. They're finally starting to see some inflation. And I expect that they're now at 1.375. I expect them to be at 2.625 by the middle of next year. And Australia will still be at 1.5. We've never, ever been that far below the US. In fact, the only time, apart from now, of course, because we're already below them, the only other time we were below them was in the late 1990s during the dot-com bubble. We got as much as 50 below the US. This time I'm expecting that we'll be about 120 basis points below the US. And that, of course, also means that our long-term bond rate will be below the US. We're currently 277, the US 296, and that rate has actually moved in the last few days while I've been travelling. But the key is that by the middle of next year, we'll be 40 to 50 basis points below the US. How can Australia possibly have a lower bond rate than the US? Easily, if people feel that they've got overexposure to the US and that short end of the yield curve is encouraging people to hold Australian bonds. And we're noticing it now with international investors. They're going, you're still AAA, and we will allow it. So the point is that the rise in bond rates that we will see associated with the US means that we won't take as much pain in the higher bond rates as the US. The other important point is around the Aussie dollar. It's currently at 75 cents. I think that within a year or so it'll be down at 70 cents. Now just let me, I've taken credit for being very good at interest rates, not so good at the Aussie dollar. In fact, back in January I was surprised by this article that said that in 2017 Bill Evans owned the forecasting of the Australian economy. And I thought, how can that be right? Because I got the Aussie dollar so wrong. Fortunately, that wasn't part of the measuring device. If they'd done that, I don't think I would have been anywhere near the top. So basically, there's two things that drive the Aussie dollar. If we look at the black bit there, that's the Aussie dollar trade weighted index. So that's Aussie against everything else. And the red bit is the US dollar. So the red dot there is where the Aussie dollar was a year ago in terms of its trade weighted, and the purple is where the US dollar was. So my view was that the Aussie dollar would fall and the US dollar would rise, but of course that didn't happen. The US dollar has continued to weaken substantially. Why did the US dollar weaken so much last year? Well, you might say Mr. Trump. You might also say that when the world is feeling fantastic, you don't want to be in the US dollar. You want to be in these currencies that tend to be more leveraged with confidence. And that's the euro, the Aussie dollar, other currencies like that. So the US dollar, which is seen to be a safe haven, suffered badly last year. But around January this year, things changed. As you know, there was a big sell-off in the equity market. People started to think, well, maybe those interest rate differentials that the US offers us are pretty good. They also started to get disillusioned with Europe. Europe grew at 2.5% last year against its trend growth of 1.25%. Euro got up to 1.25. Everything was right with the world. Macron had been elected. Merkel actually cobbled together a government, etc. What's happened this year? The confidence in Europe has changed a lot. And of course now we're thinking about the potential exit of Italy from the euro, which obviously won't happen. But suddenly things have changed a lot in terms of confidence around the euro. And we're starting to see the US dollar picking up. So over the next 12 months, I think the Aussie index will fall a bit further. But most importantly, I'll see some further recovery in the US dollar. In terms of interest rate differentials, which will also be important for the currency, if we look at the market is now predicting that by the end of this year, Aussie rates will be 75 basis points below US rates. Our forecast is 63. But next year, the market is still behind. The market thinks that next year, the US and Australia will raise rates lockstep. And that is once again an error. Because the US will go harder than the market expects and Australia will be on hold. So by the middle of next year, our rates will be more than 100 basis points below the US, which will start to also take its toll on the currency. In terms of the global story, the global manufacturing PMI is the most high-frequency measure of what's happening globally. And it looks as if that peaked at a pretty high level in the final quarter of last year. Since then, the PMI for Korea, for China, for Europe and for Japan have come off. In the US, of course, it's going the other way because of the tax cuts. But it looks as if the peak story for the global economy was last year. For me, the thing I watch most closely is global liquidity. And what we are now starting to see is this huge lift in global liquidity that came about as a result of the quantitative easing of the central banks. Both the Fed, the ECB and the Bank of Japan is easing. The Fed is now actually shrinking its balance sheet. The ECB has signalled they'll stop adding to liquidity by September this year. And the Bank of Japan is adding a lot less than it was. The other one, of course, is the Chinese shadow banking system. And that emerged from nowhere after the GFC and has grown to a level almost double the degree of stimulus coming from these other economies. And what is very important is that Mr. Xi, when he was appointed for life back in November, he said, I want to do three things: pollution, poverty and leverage. And the leverage that he's attacking is that shadow banking system. And that's very important for Australia. We're already seeing some evidence of that. The red bar looks at the growth in the system this year relative to the black bar of last year. So they're pushing more money into the banking sector. Now, the thing about the shadow banking system is that it's been used to fund most of the offshore investments that's coming out of China. It's also been funding local government, which is about 80% of infrastructure investment, and property developers and property speculators and commodity speculators. The reason is that if you want to put your money in the shadow banking system, you're expecting a higher return. So what they're trying to do is slow that system down. And as that system slows down, less global liquidity coming out, so we'll find that the impact on the rest of the world from China will be more contained. In a country like Australia that's relied on China a lot for property investment, for commodity speculation, and in particular for exporting of our resources into that steel industry in China, we'll find the edge will come off that as that policy continues to be observed. So I expect to see the iron ore price coming off. Now, Melinda's giving me a wake-up. I've only got one more point to make, and that's around inflation in the US. So we've seen 3.9% full employment in the US. We know their full employment rate's about 4.75%. So why haven't we seen inflation? Well, we're finally starting to see some pressure in the wages sector. We're also starting to see a little bit of inflation coming in the overall inflation story. And what that will mean is that US bond rates will continue to rise. So the black line there is the PE ratio for the US, and the red line is the bond rate inverted. And the big adjustment we had in those PEs earlier on in the year was a catch-up to that rise in the bond rate from the low twos to 3%. Now, if I'm right and the inflation story continues, we are going to see another upward leg in bond rates over the course of the next 12 months. And when that happens, we'll see another major adjustment in their share market. And that's something that people need to be aware of. They shouldn't go, oh, gee, that's a surprise. What happened there? You'll see it happening, all right, and that's when the bond rate gets up to in the mid-threes, there will be another major adjustment. For Australia, Australia's bonds will follow, but as I said, nowhere near as rapidly as the US. So we'll be a more benign adjustment. And as you can see, our PEs, of course, are a lot more stable through this cycle than we've seen in the US. So that's my piece. I've got a few comments here, but clearly I'm running out of time. So thank you very much for the opportunity to speak for a short amount of time. And thank you, Melinda, for the invitation.
Thanks. Okay, so we're all feeling a lot poorer after that. We've got flat wages. We've all just realised how much our housing prices have crashed. Have you got any good news for us, Bill? And we should be getting out of our equity investments. When was that again?
Well, let's put it this way, Melinda. If you're in Sydney and Melbourne, you've got a lot better news than if you're in some of the other parts of the country.
Yeah, I guess so. And we've had a lot more appreciation in recent years as well. We've got a couple of questions that have come through on the SMS. First one, in wages, isn't the issue underemployment rather than unemployment?
Yes. Well, Australia's underemployment rate actually lifted a bit in the last quarterly numbers, and that's one of the reasons why you're not getting the wages pressure. So if we look at last year, the unemployment rate has basically been stuck around 5.5, 5.6, and yet we've had record jobs growth. So why is that? The reason is that people that have been underemployed have been coming back into the workforce and have been taking any pressure off wages. So that's one of the reasons why you look at the US and you say, well, they might finally be starting to get wage pressures. But because of our underemployment story, our wage pressures are a long way out.
Okay, and we'll just ask one last one. This is a really good one. What will be the impact on the Australian share market if the ALP stops refunds of franking credits?
I guess the question is how important are the people that invest in those franking credits in terms of supporting the market? Mm. You know, there are a lot of other people that buy shares apart from just people who are not paying any tax in their super fund. As you know, the irony of this policy is that when people with more than 1.6 million in their super fund actually do pay tax now. So those people actually will be able to use that tax to offset against their franking credits, whereas the people with lower super won't be able to do that. So I don't know the proportion of people that are supporting the market in that area, but I wouldn't have thought it'll be enough to have a major impact on the share market if some of these other factors are come to pass.
Thank you very much, Bill, for coming along today. Yeah. I've got a bottle of wine here for you. Please join me in thanking Bill Evans.
Thanks a lot.